The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
So tell me, because at first glance, Chris, you know, people see a rocket taking off and it blows up and they think, that doesn't seem like success, though. But walk us through why it is.
Well, the first flight of the F-14 crashed. The first flight of the F-16 wasn't even supposed to be a flight. It went out of control and the pilot barely limped into the air. The Wright brothers crashed more times than you can count. One of them almost killed Orville Wright. People don't normally see test operations. They just see airlines and expect everything to be perfect. But this was the very first orbital attempt of the biggest rocket ever built.
Chile is going to nationalize its lithium industry, the world's second largest producer of the metal essential in electric vehicle batteries. President Gabriel Boric announced a shock move in a televised address on Thursday, saying it's the country's best chance at, quote, transitioning to a sustainable and developed economy.
India will overtake China as the world's most populous nation by the middle of this year. That's according to United Nations data released this week.
India's population is not just the world's largest, it's also very young. More than 40% of the people in this country today are below the age of 25.
The huge numbers represent both a challenge and opportunity for what is now the world's fifth largest economy.
The good news is that there is a shortage of labor in the rest of the world. So for India to take advantage of that, it has to be now and at a big scale.
U.S.-made Patriot missile systems from Germany have arrived.
That's right. Kyiv has been pushing for these systems, saying it will help boost their defenses against Russia in the air. These missile systems are just the latest contribution from Western allies. Other aid includes tanks, artillery, and fighter jets as Ukraine prepares for a potential counteroffensive.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance's members all agree that Ukraine will become a member. He added that NATO's first priority is to support Ukraine's war effort.
I said in Kyiv yesterday that Ukraine's future is in the Euro-Atlantic family, and all NATO allies have agreed that Ukraine will become a NATO member.
Most of the leading economic data is consistent not just with garden variety recessions, but some of the worst recessions we've seen, and we continue to see a deterioration in the data that matters. Now, we still get pushback, but jobs, they're still so high. Let's remember, jobs are the last shoe to drop when we're in this type of environment. So when we're looking ahead, unfortunately, just about everything that we have on our docket tells us a recession is coming. And if you're going to push back against that, which you can, you have to say, well, this time is different. And it just might be. But if you're an economist with numbers, it's really hard to look at the stack of data and see anything but a recession right now.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Sheridan, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in today's program, Bullseye Craig Johnson provides his technical take on the market and says where he thinks stocks, interest rates, and various asset classes are headed. Also this week, our main host conducted a book interview on our premium FS Insider program with Matthew Pippenberg, co-author of Gold Matters, Real Solutions to Surreal Risks. We've gotten a lot of really great feedback on that interview. So today we're going to air the first part of that show where Jim and Matthew discuss why, in light of numerous trends and events, sparks are beginning to fly again in the metals market. But here, as always, is Ryan Poplava to give us a wrap-up summary of this week's major market and economic events.
The world of finance and economics is always in motion as the earnings season kicks into gear this week. 18% of companies within the S&P 500 have reported, and according to FactSet, blended earnings are still on track for a decline of 6.2% this quarter as of Friday, but the number is higher today than at the beginning of the season as companies surprise above estimates. This week has seen a mix of positive and negative news, with some companies reporting impressive earnings and others falling short. Let's take a closer look at some of the highlights this week. We saw quite a bit of influence at the industry level due to earnings this week, despite an overall sideways move in stocks. Bank of America and Lockheed Martin were among the winners this week, helping to drive gains in their respective sectors. Bank of America was initially down, but ultimately posted a 0.6% gain in their stock, contributing to a 0.3% increase in the S&P 500 financial sector on the day. Lockheed Martin's strong earnings reported helped to propel the industrial sector up by 0.5%. While Johnson & Johnson and Goldman Sachs both reported better than expected first quarter earnings, they saw their stocks fall due to revenue misses. Intuitive Surgical and Western Alliance Bancorp were among some of the best performers this week on their earnings results. Western Alliance was up 24% post its earnings release, fueling buying interest in bank stocks. It wasn't all good for the banks. Zions Bank Corporation and Truist Financial were down mid-single digits post their earnings disappointments. D.R. Horton had impressive quarterly results that had led to some buying in home builders as well this week. There were also some disappointing earnings reports, with Netflix and Tesla both falling short of expectations, with Tesla announcing pricing cuts. This led to losses in the communications services sector and a decline in the overall market due to Tesla's performance. There were other company news items I wanted to share this week that were unrelated to earnings but helped to influence some of the industrial performance we saw. Bloomberg reported that Taiwan Semiconductors may announce a cut in its CapEx budget, down by about $4 billion on the upper and lower limits of their estimates. The New York Times had a piece that suggested Samsung may switch to Bing from Chrome for its default search engine as a result of all the research and acquisitions Microsoft has made in AI. NVIDIA was upgraded to buy from reduce at HSBC, leading to some upward performance in that stock. Albemarle fell 10% in response to a Reuters report that Chile is planning to nationalize its lithium industry, which followed on a drop in Freeport-McMoRan after its earnings release same day. Despite some disappointing economic data, there were also some positive signs. The New York Empire State Manufacturing Survey for April came in stronger than expected, showing a significant improvement from the previous month. Single-unit housing starts were up, but building permits declined, driven by a decline in permits from multi-unit buildings. However, existing home sales also declined in March. Initial jobless claims increased slightly, but the overall trend remains below previous recession averages by almost half, according to Neuberg data. The April Philadelphia Fed Index slumped, and leading index was down yet again in March. Finally, there were some interesting comments from Fed officials this week, but all of them pointed towards a rate hike in May, despite some of the weak economic progress we've seen over the past couple of months. St. Louis Fed President Bullard acknowledged the need for further rate hikes due to persistent inflation, while Atlanta Fed President Bostic suggested one more hike followed by a hold period could be in front of us. The New York Fed President Williams signaled support for another rate hike at the May FOMC meeting, while Cleveland Fed President Mester suggested policy needs to move further into tightening territory. Philadelphia Fed President Harker also weighed in, saying the Fed will need to do more to get inflation back down to target. There was some news on federal budget politics this week. Stocks got a bit of a boost at the beginning of the week on CNN News that House Speaker McCarthy said he thinks he has the votes needed in the House to raise the debt ceiling, as he also told CNBC earlier in the week that a no-strings-attached increase would likely not pass. There will be more, I'm sure, on this story in the month ahead. That covers this week's news on Wall Street. There will be a very long list of Dow industrial companies next week. Some of the very big names that will be announcing are Coke, 3M, General Motors, General Electric, Pepsi, Verizon, Microsoft, Intel, MasterCard, and finishing up the week will be Chevron and Exxon to end on Friday. I don't expect to hear about Fed rate cuts anytime soon, despite recent economic weakness, as the advanced GDP estimates will arrive next week. Thus far, the Atlanta's GDP now forecasts growth of 2.5%, which is above the Fed's recent long-run projections around 1.8%. The next Fed meeting will be here in 2 weeks, but I don't expect any surprises at this point, away from maybe just getting a quarter point hike. Up next, this week's guest technician, Craig Bullseye Johnson.
To me, there is a hype cycle here that people are extrapolating perhaps too much from where the technology is right now. What's helped, I think, in terms of the hype cycle is that ChatGPT in particular, it has a very nice interface. And when you type things in, the average person can see an output that looks really quite compelling. But as an expert on my side, when you scratch beneath the surface, there's still a lot of work that you need to do to make these tools work for you. So my sense is I do think that the sentiment probably has moved too far, and we probably are in the kind of overshooting phase of the hype cycle, and there is a lot of scope for big disappointment to occur in this space. So I think that is perhaps another reason why we could start to see big tech start to falter off the back of some change in sentiment.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At a time, bank deposits offer very low interest and could be at risk. Corporate cash accounts are also progressively losing ground to inflation. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we offer a solution to this problem. Our firm specializes in assisting companies by managing cash balances with short-term treasuries and high-quality corporate bonds that may provide higher interest rates. This approach not only helps to manage your corporate cash balances with competitive yields, but also to help reduce taxes through the use of treasury securities, which are exempt from state and local income taxes. Give us a call today at 888-486-3939 to find out how we can assist you to earn higher interest rates with no bank risk and no state and local income taxes. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us from Piper Sandler is Bullseye Craig Johnson. Craig, I want to go back to the last time we had you on the show. You like to go with themes, you know, each year. And your theme was a hop, a drop, and a pop. Where do we stand on that?
Yeah, Jim, we were looking for, starting out the year, the hop, a drop, and then ultimately a pop into year end. And where I think we're still at with that is I still think we're in the hop phase. And I've been sort of writing up in our work that we think that we can work our way higher in terms of the S&P toward 42, maybe 4,300 before, you know, the drop phase starts to come in. And, you know, Jim, we've been also talking about the drop what comes from. We think it's either going to be, you know, the Fed accomplishing its goals and ultimately slowing the economy enough that we start to see 10-year bond yields come down and the bond market sort of signals that the Fed has sort of snuffed out the inflationary concerns, or it could be from the Fed actually cutting. And you look at world interest rate probabilities, and again, I know that's inconsistent with the house view here at Piper, but at the end of the day, it suggests that there could be a cut maybe later this year. But that's where I think the drop could ultimately come from. But Jim, I got to tell you, the pop is kind of where I want people to keep their eye on. I mean, they're going to get some volatility in the near term here, but the pop by year end still, I think, could take us up another 11 to 12% higher, up to about 46.25 by year end. I know that's not consensus, Jim, but God, I seem to thrive outside of the consensus on a regular basis.
Well, you've always been one of the more bullish technicians we have on the program, and you've earned that name, Bullseye, because a lot of your bullish forecasts come true. So let's talk about this. There's a lot of negativity in the market. We've got geopolitical events. We've got the economic numbers, as Nancy Lazar at your place is talking about, are pointing to a possible recession in the third and fourth quarter. But Craig, as we look at these economic numbers, which have been negative, we also have the market that seems to be telling us a totally different story.
I think the psychology right now of this market suggests that this recession could be a mile wide and a mile deep. I think the markets are telling us that it might be an inch wide and an inch deep. And I think that's where some of the difference is coming through. And so that's why when we look at this market, Jim, I'm sort of favoring the trend lines over the headlines at this point in time, because the markets are telling us that they are not as worried about the recession. And we have already seen the Dow, the Russell, the S&P, the NASDAQ, the Dow Transport Index, they've all reversed downtrends off of either their November or January highs just, you know, a year or so ago. And we've also seen 50-day moving averages crossing back above 200-day moving averages. So from the most simple perspective, Jim, for all of the listeners out there, you can't look at this market and say we're in a relief rally anymore. We have to say we're at least trending higher. It may not be bullishly trending higher, but we are trending higher based upon those reversals, based upon those intermediate term moving averages. And Again, at this point in time, the trend is my friend and the trend is up.
Let's talk about some specific sectors. One of the things that really surprised me, technology has been doing well. The semiconductors have taken off. What's going on there? Is this the new leadership?
It seems like the leadership in the market has been semiconductors. It seems like the software names want to reassert themselves again. I think it is going to be something that's probably going to work in here for a while longer. The biggest debate I keep hearing from most managers is, should we take a little bit off the table in semiconductors, put a little bit more into software? And that's kind of where people are sort of going back and forth at this point in time. I think they both look pretty good. If I had to give you a little bit of an edge, Jim, I would say the software seems to be a little less exploited right now. You look at something like an NVIDIA, great company, nothing wrong, but it's also had a pretty sharp move. It feels like you could take a little off the table, wait for it to come back, and again, buy it again. But it's not broken. It's just maybe just a little bit ahead of itself.
Now, let's talk about something that has been inflationary, and that is the oil markets and the commodity markets. If you look at gold and silver, we got a nice pop in gold. It's been pulling back lately. Same with silver. Silver got over 25 bucks, and then oil got over 80. What's your take on commodities here?
Well, let's break these apart. First, if we talk about the energy side of the house, oil is in a downtrend. It's below its declining 200-day moving average. And in recent weeks, post the OPEC Plus meeting, we had this sort of pop in the oil price, but we were not able to get through that declining 200-day moving average. So I'm expecting some profit taking in here on the oil side in here, Jim, which I think will ultimately be deflationary. In terms of the dollar, in terms of gold, in terms of silver, I think we got to look at all those together. And the weakness and the lower trend that we're seeing in the dollar suggests that we are going to see the gold continue to be probably a little bit strengthened with the weaker dollar out there a little bit, is what I would think would ultimately happen. But in terms of the gold and silver, I think those are primarily bought to be more defensive sort of hedges in the market for a lot of people. And again, I'm not really there. I think there's better returns to be had in equities and cyclicals and other parts of the market.
And if you were to take a look at the sectors right now, because we have things that are a little bit more on the defensive, whether it's utilities, it's healthcare, or consumer staples that are doing well. But yet on the other side, you've got technology or things that are more growth and let's say risk on wise.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting observation. You look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, Jim, and you're like 8% off of all-time highs. You look at the Russell 2000 growth, you're still around 32% off of your all-time highs. I think there's going to be this sort of rotation eventually back toward growth, and there'll be sort of a premium paid toward growth as the economy sort of continues to get kind of reset with the way the Fed is ultimately tightening things. But I do think that growth will hit a premium once again. And I do think you'll see the growth stocks, I think, start to come back. And in terms of large versus small out there, Jim, and in terms of the individual sectors, I've definitely been noticing this sort of rotation out of defense of parts of the market. A prime example is look at a chart of like United Healthcare. Great company, probably not a great stock right now, as more people are going back and getting procedures done that they've been putting off for a while. But yet you're seeing more of the defensive parts of the market, staples, the larger cap parts of healthcare, not all of it, but parts of it that are definitely been rolling over. And that rotation has been going back toward the tech stocks and some of the more beaten up software parts of it. And some of it also into the semiconductors, which has already played out. I think that that rotation is going to continue. And what we have done to try to capture it, this and try to stay in front of it is we've remained overweight energy. We've remained overweight industrial. So again, playing the cyclicals, but yet we upgraded just this month technology back to an overweight. And we took financials that was an overweight to a neutral just to recognize that the banks, and again, we didn't really own the banks. We owned the insurance companies and we owned other things, but we do think the banks problems are largely behind it. The liquidity issue they had has been resolved with the Fed activities, but the banks are probably more appropriate and neutral as they're going to take some time to heal. I don't think they deserve to be an underweight. They're too beat up. You look at the XLF or you look at the KRE or some of these other indexes, there's a real good opportunity that there could be a nice rebound or relief rally in those names. It's going to take a little bit of time, though.
Let's talk about another sector of the market, and that's interest rates. We saw what the irony of this, is we had rising interest rates. I remember getting over 5% on treasury bills. We had the bank crisis. And the funny thing about it, the bank crisis brought interest rate yields down, which certainly helped the banks. But now they're rising again. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, I think in terms of interest rates, so if we step back and you look and you just visualize a very long-term chart of 10-year bond yields, Jim, where we're at is we've reversed probably the longest downtrend we will ever see and experience in our investing career. That's about a 40-year downtrend reversal. And Jim, when you get those sort of reversals, you initially surge and move higher. We've done that. And then you start backing and filling. I think you're in that backing and filling process. The trend is unquestionably lower at this point in time, despite the most recent sort of near-term move up in 10-year bond yields. The trend is still clearly lower at this point in time. I think you're going to see rates come in even further, as you're going to see the Fed probably go another 25 basis points. That's the consensus at the May meeting coming up in a couple of weeks. But after that, I expect 10-year bond yields to probably close the year somewhere around 3.25-ish type percent is kind of where I would suspect that this is going to play out.
And so lower bond yields, that should help the housing market. Let's talk about the home builders.
You know, one of the things that I've been consistently hearing is that the home builders shouldn't work with interest rates going up the way they've gone up. I think you also have to take into consideration how far lumber prices have gone down. So while you're probably paying a higher interest rate, you're also got lower material costs coming in for lumber, which will be a key component to go into the housing, to the new house that is being ultimately built or the remodeling job getting done. But if we just step back and look at charts of Lennar or Pulte or Toll Brothers or any of these, they're gapping higher and in some cases breaking out the highs we haven't seen in 52 weeks, in some cases all-time new highs. I think that's a pretty good sign for the economy. If housing is doing well, and there's still a lot of cars that need to get manufactured, Jim. And I've always been told that the two biggest things we need to take into consideration for any economy to be functioning well is housing needs to be working and autos need to be working. And I think it's going to take a number of years before these automobile manufacturers catch up and get levels back to where they want to be. I think you're running around a 14 million production for cars. And I think it needs to be a couple million higher than that, Jim.
You know what really surprises me? They talk about the consumer and inflation. But Craig, whenever I go out to a restaurant, they're packed.
You're making the same observation in California that I am making in the Midwest or in New York or in Europe when I'm doing those travels. Same kind of thing. I think the reality is that there is money out there. Jim, I remember that when I started in the business, you look at what was sitting in money market funds and you were like, $500 million sitting in money market funds. As of this last week, you've got $4.7 trillion sitting in money market funds. So while there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines that's maybe not getting a great return, there is money out there. And I do think that people post the pandemic still feel like they want to go out and spend. But the big thing that I don't think people are really paying attention to is nobody's going back into the office 5 days a week anymore. It is perhaps 2 days a week, maybe 3 days a week. And I'll tell you, you start adding that up. Caught 110, 120 million workers in this country not having to pay anywhere from $25 a day to some of the East Coast or West Coast locations where you could be paying $100 or $150 a day to go into the office. All of a sudden, you've got some pretty nice pickup in income, Jim, that you didn't have before. People had this pay raise. And they're spending it and they're going out to eat and they're doing vacations that they had postponed for a while. But that's where I think a lot of this money is coming from, Jim.
You know, it was amazing. We had an analyst on this program and she was trying to book flights. I think she had speaking engagements in Asia and she had trouble booking flights. So people are also traveling, not just going out to restaurants.
But to be fair, there are also fewer flights out there at this point in time because a lot of the airlines are having a difficult time getting enough pilots because a lot of people during COVID that were pilots were more senior and they've elected to basically retire from the industry. And I think it's kind of a staffing issue. I would just point out to, you know, Southwest Airlines as an example of that. When they run into any sort of snafu, they really cascades on them very quickly because there's guidelines that they have to meet in terms of rest and time for these pilots, and they clearly don't have enough.
Yeah, I've seen that. I have friends visiting. Flights have been canceled. Flights have been postponed different times. So, Greg, if we were to sum up as we close here, what would you be doing as an investor here, given what you see in the charts?
Well, what I would be doing is I would be using any little pullback opportunities that we get, Jim, to be adding equity exposure at this point in time. I think a lot of investors have been sitting on the sidelines. They've not been putting money back to work, just again, or taking money out of the market based upon what you see with money market funds at this point in time. But I think they should be selectively finding those themes, those opportunities that they like, and they should be playing and engaging into this pullbacks. Because I really do think, Jim, by year end, our 4625 objective for the S&P 500 is very achievable. And I do think in the next several months, we're likely going to see a change from the Fed. We're probably also going to be told we're in a recession and maybe even out of the recession. And under those sort of scenarios, I think this market continue to keep grinding higher. And if we're looking for real returns in the market, you're going to have to get some of that through growth, and you're going to have to get some of that through dividends. And therefore, I think investors need to be involved in equities to at least protect themselves to get a real return because of the higher inflation out there, Jim.
Well, if you take a look at where we are with the S&P and your target of 4625, that would imply, Craig, almost another 12% gain for the S&P, making this a strong double-digit year for the markets.
Yeah, and I think that is very doable. And what I'd also say, Jim, is it's not very often that we get back-to-back negative years. And last year was the seventh worst year in terms of a total return for the S&P last year. And we'd have to have something that is going to be more like 73, 74, 07, 08, something along those lines to get those back-to-back negative years. And I guess from my perspective, stocks are telling me that that's not happening right now.
All right. Well, listen, Craig, if people want to follow you, tell them how they can easily do so.
Yeah, if they'd like to follow our research, they can find us two different ways. One, they can check out Piper Sandler. They have a Twitter feed where they will frequently post a lot of our work. They're also welcome to shoot me an email at craig.johnson@psc.com.
All right. Well, listen, Craig, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Stay well, my friend, and come back again.
Thanks, Jim.
Hi, I'm Jim Poplava. I started Financial Sense in 1985 to give clients a boutique, personal investment experience that's hard to get at a large company. For three decades, my company has been helping families build, manage, and protect their wealth through tailored financial planning and investment management. If you are looking to make financial sense of a complex world, give our office a call at 888-486-3939 to speak with one of our advisors today and let us help you plan your future.
Today we're going to air the first part of a book interview we conducted this week with Matthew Pipenberg, co-author of a highly rated book titled Gold Matters, Real Solutions to Surreal Risks.
In the opening of your book, you talk about major currencies have lost 80% of their value versus gold since the 2000. And also, I think I'd be surprised, Matthew, that the number one performing asset since 2000 has been gold.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's 80% really since 2000. But when you go back to 1971, just after I was born, so all of my life, when Nixon closed the gold window, since that period, that 50 plus year period, which remind you that Nixon promised that closing the gold window would only be temporary, just like Powell said, inflation would only be transitory. And Bernanke said QE1 would only be temporary. But, you know, 50 plus years later, every major currency, including the U.S. dollar, what, you know, every major developed economic currency has lost greater than 95% when measured against a gram of gold or a milligram of gold. So it's extraordinary off the kind of mindsets of most investors. It's not talked about in the mainstream media. It only makes up 0.5% of global assets. But gold is this, you know, little engine that could. It's amazing to me how more people don't understand that as currency insurance and as macro insurance and certainly as banking risk insurance, it's just always been slow and steady with the last laugh. And that's not meant to be an arrogant Zurich-based gold apology or smug comment. It's just common sense that gold and silver, and gold in particular, doesn't get stronger. Currencies just get weaker. And so The reason we're seeing, and there is price volatility, but there's obviously a steady trend upward since 1971. You know, the reason precious metals continue to push forward through all different types of market cycles, inflation, deflation, strong dollar, weak dollar. The real bottom line is the inherent purchasing power of currencies just keeps getting weaker as we monetize extraordinary and unsustainable debt levels with mouse click money. That is inflationary and it debases the currency. And as currency's inherent purchasing power falls, precious metal, monetary metal prices rise. And so, yes, since 71, which was a watershed moment when we welched on the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement to have our world reserve currency backed by a credible world recognized chaperone like gold. When we welched on that in 71, inflation of the currency and the debasement of the major currencies of the world, including the world reserve currency, has been steady and solid ever since. And so, you know, it's a tragic example, sadly, an historical example throughout history. When you get your back against a debt wall as a nation, the first thing you do is debase the currency. And that's where gold kind of acts as a counterweight.
You know, it's interesting because gold has acted and served as money for over 5,000 years of history. We've had derivatives of that with whether it's ETFs or something like a cryptocurrency that some say competes with that. But, you know, in your book, you talk about history has repeatedly shown without exception that every nation, empire, or regime which found itself in a debt trap from which it could never escape has consistently resorted to debasing its currency to inflate it, weigh its debt. And that's certainly what we're doing right now in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world.
Yeah, it's not a sensational statement. It's stepping away from the math of markets and the comps and the bond spreads and the lingo of Wall Street. It's just getting to the forgotten past, but yet the oh so familiar past. And you know that famous line: "Those who don't learn their history are doomed to repeat it." This really is sadly nothing new. The cycles can seem longer than the attention spans, but this has gone on for thousands of years. And, you know, you can use the example of ancient Rome. These are classic examples, or the Ming Dynasty, or you can go to 18th century France or 1720 John Law era. But, you know, even more close to history, of course, in the 1930s, inflation was a disaster. It came out of Weimar. And what followed from that, you know, was Hitler. What followed from inflation in Spain was Franco. What followed from inflation in Italy was Mussolini. What followed from inflation in 1917 Russia was Bolshevism. What followed throughout every regime change in South America was always a debased currency from a debt-soaked nation. So it's more than just a currency problem. It's a social problem, because as these countries try to inflate away their debt by taking the monetary metal side of their money out of the picture, it buys time. It even buys euphoria. It certainly buys votes. It bought Bernanke a Nobel Prize. But in the end, it destroys the currency. And it leads, frankly, to social unrest, which is always followed by extreme centralization from the political left or the political right. And so it's more than just a financial issue. It's an historical, social, and political issue. And sadly, what we're seeing right now with the centralization of our markets, the centralization of our banking system, certainly the advent of central bank digital currency, and you know, the various lockdown measures and other media censorships and the weaponization of our dollar and the weaponization of our mainstream media, these are all subtle forms of the type of control that always creeps up as nations find themselves more and more desperate and looking for more and more excuses to explain the failing power of your wallet or the failing power of your dollar in your currency or in your wallet or in your portfolio. And they'll blame it on everything from global warming to Putin to COVID. But it's very simple. Inflation is always and everywhere about the expansion or contraction of the monetary units. It's a monetary issue. And when you print trillions and trillions of dollars to buy time and support your bond market, you're buying time and you're even buying euphoric markets. But every time, without exception, there's always a price to pay for that. And we're slowly heading in that direction. No one can time it, but the signs are getting more and more obvious.
You know, it's interesting because since 1971, when we went off gold backing of our currency, the dollar has lost 98% of its value. And I want to throw out some statistics out there for our listeners. U.S. federal debt is up 74-fold. Total U.S. debt is up 49-fold. The money supply is up 29-fold. Debt to GDP in 1971 was 37%. Today, it's over 135%. And, you know, I think, Matthew, back in the early 70s, I bought my first car. It was a Volkswagen Beetle. Thank God I got it before the OPEC oil embargo. I paid $2,000. That car today is somewhere probably close to $40,000.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's some people joke about the Big Mac indicator. You could use the Volkswagen indicator, the Beetle indicator. I mean, these things kind of are hiding in plain sight, and it's cognitive dissonance, but that you're hitting it right on the head. I mean, when you look at something that actually you can hold or see versus the dollar, which slowly disappears in front of you day after day, year after year. I mean, the years see things the days don't notice. But it's ultimately common sense. And again, it's not an apology for a precious metals executive or a gold bug or a gold bull. It really is common sense that the inherent purchasing power of a fiat currency, one that has been uniquely debased, is openly and obviously disintegrating. And again, you could compare, there's charts that compare what a dollar would buy and what a Big Mac cost when and you're talking in the 70s compared to what it would cost today. That's where you see it. And again, it's not really something people think about every day because they're looking at tech stocks, they're looking at FANG stocks, they're looking at headlines, they're looking at what their neighbors are doing, what their partners are doing, they're looking at what cryptos are doing. And it's understandable. There can be very sexy trends and runs, and the opportunity cost, it seems, going into something as boring and calm and as intelligent as precious metals when you can make 30x on a certain stock or a certain sector in a given market or given trend, people don't want to look at the hangover that's coming or the currency crisis is coming because it does seem too sensational. There's a lot of out of sight, out of mind. And I was certainly among those people in the late 90s, you know, trading IPOs and tech stocks and running a fund and thinking that was, you know, heaven on earth. But there's always a price to pay for drunk driving at the central banks and drunk driving in DC with deficit spending and all the debt numbers that you just listed. These boring macro data points aren't just statistics that people can throw around. They have a massive impact long-term, and that long-term is coming. You know, it's coming home to roost now in so many ways, but as you said, it's been happening slowly but surely right in front of us every day. And but I think even more extraordinary and more alarming is it won't be fully understood in that commonsensical slow history drip until there's real panic in the markets and real inflation that just becomes unavoidable and you feel it. Many people don't have time to look at the CPI scale and how completely distorted it is and look at Fed policy and understand what QT versus QE means or what a M2 or M3 money supply means. And I really understand that. Everyone has different priorities and things in their life. But for those of us who track these things, the signals towards a real turning point aren't meant to be sensational or clickbait. You know, they're really meant to teach the world to prepare for a turning point. And we're already in it in a lot of ways. But it's more than sensational. And it's more than a scare tactic to convince people to buy a misunderstood and often unloved asset like physical gold or physical silver.
In your book, you cite a professor, Andrew White, who wrote a book called Fiat Money in France. Looking at his book, he makes some parallels. He was talking about 1789 France, which led to a revolution as inflation really took hold of the country. In the parallels to the 2020s, we're moving down that same path. Explain that.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. That was, again, Andrew Dickinson White was someone I'd never heard of, and certainly why would you? It was a kind of a forgotten book written in 1912 from Cornell University in a time. And I was at that time running a family office or a managing director of a family office. And I was investing in certain hedge funds. And one of my favorite portfolio managers took me aside and said, you got to read this crazy book. It's so much like what we're seeing post, you know, 2008 and certainly to the 2020s now. But this idea that you could solve a debt crisis with more debt and pay for that debt with money created out of nowhere. It's fascinating the parallels between pre-Napoleonic 1789 France and the current state of the U.S. monetary policy. What it was, and I'll try and do as briefly as I can, is In 1789, France, much like the U.S., was one of the great powers of the world, if not the greatest powers, but it found itself in a debt trap. It was had extended wars. Its markets were down. Its currency was still strong, but there was not a lot of faith in its economy. There was distrust on the streets, and there was a need for some immediate solution, much like we saw in 2008. There was distrust on the streets, markets were tanking, the dollar was still strong, but there was a need for a miracle solution. And there was what would be the equivalent of a Ben Bernanke in 1789, the central banker, the main finance minister at the time in France was a guy named Necker. And his solution was, why don't we print some money, basically? They were called assignats in France, but it was basically a version of QE1. And Necker, like Bernanke, said, we can only do this once. This is dangerous. We don't want to get carried away. You know, we can give a little stimulus, print some money, pay down some debts, support the markets, keep people happy. It'll be a temporary solution, and that'll be that. And just like Bernanke, and then, you know, Necker got a little addicted to that. It was a pretty nice solution. Hey, we've got a debt problem. We've got a surplus problem. We've got a deficit problem. Let's just print a few more hundred million assignats and solve it, you know, magically with the wave of a wand. We don't have to have this money chaperoned by gold or by a service or a real asset. We'll just create out of thin air. And that was euphoria until there was a hiccup. And then they went to what was the equivalent of QE2 and then QE3 and QE4. Just like we saw post Bernanke with Yellen and Powell, you know, this need. You know, remember, Bernanke promised in 2009 that QE1 would be temporary, and we've gone to QE1, QE2, QE3, QE4, Operation Twist, and then unlimited QE after March 2020. So this temporary solution becomes very addictive, just like it would be if any of us had a money printer in our basement and we could legally create money at will whenever we needed to pay a bill. Who wouldn't want to use that solution? The problem is it's not legal for us citizens, but it is totally legal for the central banks in 1789 France or then 2009 America to do that. And it buys a great deal of euphoria. As I used the book example, there were years where everyone looked smart. Everyone looked brilliant. At the same time, there were a few lone voices in the National Assembly in France, just like there are and there were in the U.S., like Rand Paul and others, and a few brave senators and journalists who said, wait, this isn't smart. This can't end well. and no one wanted to hear those lone voices because we're France. We're the world. We're France. We're the center of Europe. We're the greatest. And we've got this great system. Just like in America, hey, we're the world reserve currency, we're a world power, this can't hurt us. And, you know, long story short, it destroyed France. It destroyed its currency. It led to social unrest. It led to the debasement of the currency. It led to a political cataclysm, and it led to an open door to opportunists and demagogues and centralized control like Napoleon. And what I was trying to draw a conclusion was, is this, again, this pattern has been seen in all the empires and some version of it, but it's very, very similar to the U.S. where you had a consensus of crazy that made everyone happy. And so they ignored the inflationary effects of adding this much fake money into a system. Just like if you add buckets of water to a glass of wine, you dilute the wine. Well, you dilute the currency. And that happened slowly and then all at once. And it was a major crisis. Again, very similar patterns to the U.S. Many would argue, yes, but unlike France in 1789, the United States is the world reserve currency. It's the world power. It's unstoppable. Those were the same things the French were saying to themselves, too, until it all blew up. And it did blow up. And again, it wasn't the end of France. It wasn't the end of the world, but it was the end of a fake France. And it was the beginning of a much more painful, economically controlled and less free France under Napoleon. And that is the warning and the pattern that we've seen throughout history. Again, 1930s fascism, the rise of Bolshevism, the powers that take control in South America. It always from inflation leads to some type of centralized control with more debasement of the currency and more scapegoats and really more less and less civil liberties. So it is more than just a financial problem. It's a social problem and it's a political problem again, but it's extraordinary, the parallels. And that book written in 1910, 1911, published 1912, ironically was a warning against central banks and a warning against something as stupid as what the French did. And no one thought that could happen again. And ironically, a year after that book was written, is when the U.S. Fed was written into law under Woodrow Wilson. So it's very ironic that that book came out as the Fed was meeting secretly in Jekyll Island, a cabal of bankers to create this beast called the central bank, the Fed. And reminder, Thomas Jefferson has, you know, warned that a central bank would be the end of America. And Andrew Jackson later said that a central bank like the Fed would be the prostitution of the government at the expense of the many for the benefit of the few. And that is exactly true. The euphoria that the Fed created with all this money printing was in a massive stock and bond bubble for which, you know, the top 10% of the U.S. population enjoyed 90% of those returns. So there was historical wealth inequality in the boom times since we started printing money. And for many of us, that's fine. But for the majority of Americans, especially the middle class, they are being crippled. And we're not even in a market crisis yet, a real market crisis. So these things are very, very patterned. History doesn't repeat itself perfectly, but as Mark Twain said, it rhymes. And that example in 1789 in France was just one of many, but I thought it was incredibly telling, the overlap of words used to hide bad math, political opportunism, euphoric markets, a debauched class of speculators, just like we saw in the dot-com bubble or the real estate markets in the MBS bubble. It was very, very similar. It creates wonderful keg parties followed by horrific hangovers. And we have been postponing that hangover with a mouse click at the central bank, at the Eccles building. And that seems magical, but it's not. Commonsensically, we all know that if it seems too good to be true, it is. And again, it's not sensational. History points the way. The problem is for people say, well, when is it going to blow? And no one knows. But I think the signs that we're seeing in the credit markets, the credit event disruptions we've seen in the last 3 years, and the desperation by our politicians to hide, you know, very bad math with comforting platitudes is more and more a sign that we're coming, I think, very close to a tipping point. Again, not the end of the world, not the end of America, not even the end of the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency, but definitely the end of American hegemony and definitely the end of the euphoria and the good times that we've known really for so many decades. It's going to be a very different America for those who are unprepared, particularly. I just really truly believe that.
You bring up a statistic, and this is, I guess, supporting where we're heading here. Global debt is now $300 trillion. So it's not just a U.S. issue. It's a Europe issue, Chinese issue, Japan issue. You know, things like since 2008, M2 is up 500%, mm-hmm. tenfold in one decade, mm-hmm. and a growing movement towards what we see censorship. Mm-hmm. You're seeing it in social media. And, you know, I just wonder how long, you know, those of us in the financial world are going to have to are going to be able to talk freely about the things that we see and warn people about.
I think I still, cynical as I am, and even as an American living overseas, I still think America, I have more faith in America, and I have faith in alternative media platforms that aren't wacky, but are just legitimately alternative. I still believe, yes, we're seeing that at Facebook, we're seeing that at Google. I don't believe Facebook and Google or even YouTube is the real voice of America, just like I don't believe CNBC or CNN or even Fox is the voice of America. But luckily, Americans find a way when they're curious to search and think critically and find voices that speak to them and resonate with them that they could agree or disagree with me. But I think they'll listen to different people's and they'll come up with their own judgment. But yes, there's been censorship is another symptom of a more desperate economy and a desperate politics. And, you know, the rise of wokeism, which is supposed to be about tolerance, is incredibly intolerant in the name of being offended or in the name of national security. Things from important things like whether a vaccine is effective or whether alternative treatments are effective or whether there's risk. Important things, debatable things. I don't have the final answer, but very important things were simply denied as fake news or as a threat to national security or as a danger to our health. And I'm not here to give the final answer on any of those debates. The problem was there wasn't even allowance for those debates. And that's a scary thing in America. It's kind of like a McCarthyism, a kind of sanctimonious McCarthyism or a Salem witch hunt kind of mentality among those in control to be completely intolerant of any other views because they're afraid of other views. And the financial markets, it's a known thing on Wall Street that bears get fired and bulls get promoted. So it's very hard to work at Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley and have a cynical view of bank policy or central bank policy or unsustainable markets. And you know, I think there was a great, great quote. It was Upton Sinclair. It's amazing what men or women are willing to forget if their salary depends on not understanding something. And the consensus think, I think, in Wall Street, which I was certainly a member of for years, is toe the line, be positive, keep clients happy. You know, markets always rebound. Central banks always save us. Don't worry. And don't start looking too dangerously into the corners of these dark statistics and these money supply things and these things that seem boring at first glance, but are incredibly important. So yeah, there is a risk of that. We're certainly seeing it. I'm very concerned about it. But I still think more and more people are finding ways to get this data without it being tinfoil hatted or end of the world or flat earth. It's just, you have to be, you know, more careful. You have to be more critical. You have to be more curious, and you have to be more patient trying to find voices that resonate with you or books that resonate with you. And I always say, even for those who follow gold and believe in a lot of things that Egon von Greyers and my partner and I say, I always say, even challenge our views. Challenge your views on crypto, challenge your views on bull markets, challenge your view on bear markets. But the more you look into these things, you'll start to rely more and more on your own informed judgment. I think what's missing today is a lack of informed understanding of risk. But I'll also be honest, I was bearish 6-7 years ago. I never thought the Fed would go to $3.5 trillion balance sheet or $4.5 trillion balance sheet. I was waiting for markets to explode years ago. I remember a lot of the analysts who worked with me in my family office said, Matt, you're so bearish. This is not, don't worry, it's going to be fine. And I was so bearish. In some ways, they were right. But like David Stockman, I couldn't believe the Fed would go from 4.5 to 7 to 8 to 9 trillion balance sheet. I couldn't believe it. So I underestimated the drunken behavior of our central bank. I underestimated them, or maybe I overestimated their intelligence and underestimated their stupidity, because we've simply bought more time. And could the Fed print another 9 trillion, another 6 trillion? Look what they did after March of 2020. We doubled our Fed balance sheet in less than 12 months, more money printing than we saw in years prior. So technically, I suppose a central bank can nationalize, so to speak, Wall Street socialism, support bond and stock markets artificially with printed money. I suppose technically you could argue the modern monetary theory can prevent markets from ever going down, but there's always a toll booth. There's always a cost. And if you print that much money to sustain the bond market and hence, and by indirectly, the stock market, you're only doing so at the cost, at the expense of your currency. So you'll have a Pyrrhic victory of a so-called market sustainability, but you'll destroy the currency. And that's when we're talking about scary things like inflation or even hyperinflation, which is, you know, another issue, because when you're in control of the money and you're in control of the message, you can, and this isn't conspiracy theory, misreport inflation by 50%. So even when people feel it on the street or at the grocery store, at the gas tank, on their vacation, on their hotel bill or in their car payments, even when they feel it, the Fed will tell you, no, don't worry, there's only this much inflation, when in fact it's twice as much. Literally, if you use the same CPI scale that Volcker used in the 80s or the 70s, we have inflation now well over 15%, just using the same metrics. But when you tweak the message and you tweak the data, you can at least politically say you're fighting inflation, reducing inflation, when in fact you're running uphill in roller skates. So again, it's just looking at this data objectively without trying to be sensational and drawing your own conclusions and challenging even your own worst assumptions or best convictions. That's something we all have to do.
That concludes the first half of our conversation with Matthew Pipenberg, co-author of Gold Matters, Real Solutions to Surreal Risks. We'll have a link to where you can pick this up on Amazon. It is a fantastic read. However, if you would like to listen to the second part of this or gain access to any of our premium podcasts airing during the week, where we also interview book authors, strategists, and industry experts from around the globe, you can do so by going to financialsense.com and hitting where it says subscribe. If you have any questions about what we discussed today on the Financial Sense NewsHour, how to subscribe, or even about our asset management or financial planning services, feel free to hit contact us on financialsense.com, or you can always give us a call at 888-486-3939. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any company. companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.